Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Ken Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing my coverage from Venice Immersive 2025, today's episode is about L'Ombre, or The Shadow. So this is a dance piece that was a part of the competition at Venice Immersive. So it's got this combination of installation where you're in this big, vast space on the island. It's actually in the back in a place that we've never been before, but they were able to get permission to perform in this space. And it's was able to hold, I don't know, like 50 or 75 people or so. And the original version of this was holding around 200 people or so. And so it's a mixed reality and a live performance. So there's live dancers that are on stage and everybody in the audience is wearing a virtual reality headset that has this kind of mixed reality overlay. In the original depiction of this, they actually have like more of a projection map. And so on top of that, then they have other virtual reality components as well. But you could basically watch the experience without any virtually mated headset in the original version. But in this version, they're kind of replacing all of that projection map that was originally there within the context of the VR headset. And so it's based upon the Hans Christian Andersen tale, The Shadow, and basically they're playing that out through the course of this as a framework to show the narrative. Although I'd say I wasn't familiar with that narrative and I wasn't necessarily able to follow the story per se, but just appreciate the aesthetics of the dance as it's unfolding. So the contextual domains that are being explored is that there's a dance performance, but creates the feeling of being within a specific neighborhood via mixed reality. So it's kind of transportive in that way. It makes you feel like you're kind of in the city as you're watching them dance on the rooftops. But it's also a story about something from the invisible, hidden in shadow realms, being incarnated and coming to life and being embodied as a corporeal entity. Then this entity becomes an enemy, enslaves his masters, and then essentially ultimately kills him from an attack. So the overall center of gravity is the earth element in terms of this embodied sense of space and also this kind of more theatrical staging of a dance performance that's happening there. But the audiences are wearing these mixed reality headsets to mimic those projector map that was originally there in the original experience. But there's also this kind of fusion of the live music that's happening there, as well as with the audio that's coming from the immersive audio from your headset. So there might be stuff that passes by and you hear more of a spatialized audio, but there's also this layer of electronic music that's setting the tempo for everybody, but also the live musician is playing as well. So it's kind of described as an ambitious immersive dance, music, and mixed reality show. So the second center of gravity is the fire element, the active presence, the liveness of the live, of the live performances, of both the dance performance and the music performance that's happening live. There are pre-recorded aspects of the audio and the music, but there is a live track that's happening and dynamic each time. There's no real narrative agency for the audience, so we're mostly sitting still. In this instantiation, in the previous version of this, you could actually move your body around a lot more as you're walking through the space and get multiple perspectives. And so you did have a little bit more agency to move around in the original version. But because of the limitations of the space and the security and safety concerns, nobody was basically moving around. They're all sitting down watching this from a singular perspective. The water element in terms of the timing and the music. So the music that was happening was live on top of the pre-recorded music. So a bit of the chronos of the recording and the kairos of the liveness of the live. But also there's this synchronization that has to happen between what's happening within the context of the performance, as well as the cues that are happening within the virtually mediated space. There's a lot of timing stuff that's happening in terms of the timing of the performances with this kind of virtually mediated dance partner of sorts. And so you basically have these dancers who are taking these moves, but then within the virtually mediated, you see more of a dual dance that's happening between them, which is also quite interesting to see the blending and blurring kind of mediated through their timing of that. And then finally, the fourth center of gravity is the air element in terms of the mental and social presence. It is a co-located social experience, but you're not necessarily interacting with other people. And that wasn't a real feature of it, that there were other people in the experience. I don't even know if they had necessarily any embodiments to mention. You could see other people through the mixed reality pass-through that's there, but they're not actually like engaged or doing much anything of interesting to make it more of a social experience. So it was more of that you're co-present watching this as a group. And so while it was inspired by the Hans Christian Andersen story, there's quite a poetic interpretation of that in terms of this embodied dance. So the communication of the meaning of the stories being done through these symbolic movements of the dance movements. And without really being familiar with it, and like I said, I wasn't able to really track the nuances of the story. It was more around the feeling of these contrasts between these different embodied movements that they're doing over the course of the time. And then finally, the themes and the archetypes that are being explored, that the character, I just quote from Their description, it says, quote, a scientist brings a shadow to life. It becomes autonomous and manages to pass itself off as a human being in society. The shadow overtakes its master, returns to enslave him, and ultimately kills him. I guess as I read that, it's sort of like, oh, wow, this is sort of like a story of AI of sorts as I'm reading that now. Sort of like very much a timely story in terms of the different technologies that we create that overtake us, or this, you know, Frankenstein's monster back to Mary Shelley. So yeah, I guess that's what we'll be covering on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So the director of this was Bianca Lee, and I was not able to talk to her. I was hoping to, but then just wasn't able to happen in real time. I was able to talk to her husband and producer and like president of her whole company, Etienne Lee, to be able to talk about her process. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this conversation with Etienne happened on Tuesday, September 2nd, 2025 at Venice Immersive in Venice, Italy. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
So my name is Etienne Lee, and I work with Bianca Lee. We both run the company Bianca Lee, which is basically a dance company, but also a company that does virtual reality shows. And for this event here in Venice, we do the international premiere of The Shadow, which is a mixed reality live show. It combines live performance and virtual reality, and you can see both together for a lot of people together.
Great. Maybe you could give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into this space.
So my background is I met Bianca Lee when we were both students. She was a student in choreography at Martha Graham School in New York, and I was a PhD student in mathematics and at Columbia University. And we met, and she started doing shows in New York, pretty much underground shows in like the venues in the Lower East Side, like the Pyramid Club and places like this. And I helped her from the beginning to do sets, costumes, lighting, and anything that goes behind the stage. So after 6 years in New York, we moved back to Europe. And she started doing shows in Madrid and performing. At the time, it was more like flamenco rap band. I mean, she was doing a lot of music and performance. And we also did a show in Morocco with Moroccan musicians that we brought to Lincoln Center Out of Door Festival. So it was a pretty wide range of performance that we were producing. And then after a few years, we decided to move to Paris because I had a very good position as a professor, mathematics professor for engineering schools. So that was 1992, and we founded the dance company in Paris in 1992. And since then, we've been performing large shows that are touring across the world, more than 20 full-size shows that we've been performing at places like Brooklyn Academy of Music, New York City Center, The Kitchen for New York venues, and National Theater of in Taiwan, in Seoul, in Japan, and mostly, of course, in Europe, in France, Italy, Spain, UK, Switzerland, Belgium, and so on.
And so maybe you could give a bit more context for how virtual reality started to become on your radar and Bianca's radar in order to start to do these mixed reality performances.
So I guess that's 2013 when Google put out its cardboard headset where you were putting an iPhone inside and you could have actually VR experiences on their cardboard headsets. So she saw the first experiences, which were like a roller coaster things, and she found it very interesting from the point of view of a choreographer who always likes movement. And so her first production was a 360 movie that she did in 2015. And that was something in which we did an like employees working in an open space. We were actually dancers and performing like as close as possible to the camera. The 360 camera rig at the time, there wasn't any, so we sort of made it up by ourselves. And then the post-production was very interesting, and because we had to stitch all the different images together, and we learned a lot about what 360 could do. Then once she finished that, it was a short movie, about 5 minutes, that was produced by one of the French TV channels, which is Arte. At the time, they were having a platform for 360 content. So they put it on their platform. It was available for a few years, but Blanca found that being close to the dancer wasn't enough. I mean, she wanted the viewer to be himself present inside the experience. So that's when she started thinking about Le Bal de Paris, which was an experience in which the audience would actually be an avatar inside a world and be together with the dancers. So we started Le Bal de Paris production in 2017. We came to Venice Film Festival in 2018 to see who was doing things approaching that, and we found that there was very few things for a certain number of spectators. Then we approached different studios and we decided to go with Backlight Studio, who was promising to allow an experience to run for 10 to 12 audience members, all with real-time motion capture and avatars. So the pandemic came in the middle, and so that made the production go a little more slowly, but we managed to premiere the show in Venice Immersive Festival in 2021. It was actually the only one which was physical, because at the time everything was online. But we did the performance at the Conservatorio Marcello Benedetti on the main Venice Island. And so the people were coming and doing the experience, and they really found it something that didn't exist before. The costumes were designed by Chanel, and Chanel participated in the production by financing it. So there was 12 audience members, 3 dancers, and acting the main characters of the story for a 40-minute experience that goes through 3 different, very different settings, like a ballroom, a garden party, and a nightclub in Paris. So each of these settings is the occasion for people to dance together and to dance with the dancers while the dancer act the main characters. So that won the prize for best VR experience at the Venice Film Festival. And since then, we've been touring. And a point of view is to match the expectation of a venue like a theater. We have to be able to bring hundreds of spectators every day. So we managed to do this by doing 5 spaces together with 12 spectators each. So that's 60 spectators. And because the experience runs for 40 minutes, we can repeat it every hour. And so we did that in Chaillot Theatre, which is the main national theatre for dance, up to 12 times a day. So we had 600 spectators per day, actually, doing VR experience. And since that October 21 performance in Chaillot, we've been performing in many different countries for, I would say, 60,000 to 70,000 spectators. We've been running nearly every day. Most of the time it's only 20 spectators an hour, but still we're reopening in Paris 2 weeks from now for 50 spectators per hour.
Great. And that's a great overview and history and evolution of integrating with the virtual reality, mixed reality headsets. And the challenge of throughput is something that a lot of folks within the XR industry have been challenged by, and it sounds like you've been able to scale it up. And so Bianca was unable to make it today, and so you're able to speak about the history. And just a quick follow-on clarification, because you said you were a math professor. Are you still teaching math, or are you also working with what capacity and what title do you have in the capacity of some of these productions? Just trying to get a bit more context.
Well, all those years, I worked as a math professor for engineering students. So I guess that was also an interest that made Blanca very aware of what was available in terms of technology. We did a show with humanoid robots, and I sourced the robots, who were the Now robots designed by the French company Aldebaran in 2013. Every time there is a technological challenge, I'm mostly the one who helps her finding, sourcing the people and the technology for this. So I actually, last year, because we found that the activity of Blanca was going very strong and that she had a lot of projects going on, we decided that I would stop teaching and dedicated myself 100% to her company. So since I've been president of Blanca Lee Company for 1 year, And at the same time, she was named president of the La Villette, which is a public theater in Paris and a park with lots of outside activities. And so she's been president of La Villette for 1 year. Before that, she was for 5 years the artistic director of one of the largest theater in Madrid, which was the Teatro del Canal, where she programmed a lot of dance shows, but also theater, music, and digital art exhibitions. So this is something that now she decided that she would concentrate on her artistical career. So she has stopped La Villette, and she's in the process of stopping La Villette, because she found over that year of being the president that she had to make a choice between artistic activities and being able to do full energy for artistic activities and directing a large public institution.
Yeah, and so maybe you could give a bit more context for how The Shadow came about.
So The Shadow came out about 3-4 years ago. It was a project that was initiated by Edith Canat de Chizy, who's a music composer with whom we have worked before on a stage show. And she was associated with IRCAM, which is the Institute for Contemporary Music and Research in Paris. So she asked Blanca to come to a meeting and say, I have this project about adapting the Hans Christian Andersen tale, which is The Shadow, in music. And maybe if you want, you can do the choreography. And talking with the IRCAM, Blanca said, okay, I think there's one thing that would work very well with the tale, because the tale tells a story of a shadow becoming independent from a human being and eventually overcoming and killing the human being when the shadow takes the human being's place, is that she would use virtual reality, that she would use mixed reality, which was just beginning, and explore the possibilities of mixed reality to create independent shadows from performers and have live performers and virtual shadows acting together on the same space. So the production went on for about 6 months of testing to see what was possible, end of 2023 and beginning of 2024. And then it's been close to a year of production, working on creating the graphics, animations, doing motion capture with the dancers. So the dancer would rehearse in our studio space and they would rehearse the live choreographies. And once they had the choreographies in mind, well rehearsed, they would go into our motion capture studio and would motion capture them and give them to the animators and graphic designers so they would integrate into Unity and make a project. We decided very late which headset we would use because we were expecting a French builder, which is Lynx, to provide us the headsets. And then because it wasn't ready, we had to switch to other models. That was the beginning of 2025. And we chose the Pico for its capacity to do large-scale LBE audience. So when we did the premiere in Paris in May 2025, it was for a 200-person audience with 200 headsets simultaneously performing. And actually, it was very satisfying, very smooth, and technically seamless.
Yeah, here at Venice Immersive 2025, you have kind of a scaled-down version of 50 or 60 or 70 people that are seeing it at the same time. But maybe you could describe a little bit about some of the differences between what's showing here at Venice versus what premiered, because I understand people are walking around. There was maybe some more projection map that was happening in the original version. And so, yeah, just maybe talk about that translation between what it premiered with and what's showing here at Venice.
So when we did the show in Paris, it was for a very large space and especially with very tall walls. So we did a large scale projection on all the four walls with very high-end video projectors. And the idea of Blanca was that the show, if people didn't want to put the headset on, they could see the whole show with dancers. There's a percussionist. And so we had 10 dancers, one percussionist, the video projection, the lighting, and the immersive sound. So it makes for a whole show without the VR. And when we were invited and selected in competition for Venice, We looked for the venues, and the festival proposed us the venue where we are at now, which was, of course, much smaller and much more difficult. And especially there was nearly no space to do video projection, and the cost of doing video projection was very high. So we decided to integrate the video projection in the headsets. We thought the audience in Venice will be much more prone to keep their headsets on, because that's what they come for. So it's more pure to be seen with the VR headsets. The scale of the experience is much smaller, so it makes it more difficult. Especially we had to lower the stage. In Paris it was a free roaming standing audience. Here, if we allow for standing audience, the heads of the people will stand in the way of the dancers, so that might be a problem. So there's a lot of things which we had to make compromise to allow the experience to run in Venice, but all these compromises have also advantages. Because the audience is seated, we don't risk people hitting each other by moving around, so we can have much more darkness. Because the space is smaller, you're always closer to the performer, to the dancers, and because the quality of the headsets is really what limits the quality of the vision. If you are too far from the dancers, you don't see them very well, but here you're always close to the performers, and so the visual quality is actually better, with more contrast, with more darkness. And so I think for me, we have the large version which was in Paris and the small version which is in Venice, and both are convenient for different types of venues. I mean, and I'm happy when we propose these two different LB or venues or theaters around the world, that I can tell them we can do a small version which is for small space, and it works very well with advantages and inconvenience, and it can do a large scale version. And we're thinking to do even two more versions, one for square space and one for like a traditional theatrical audience, where the audience is seated in a normal theater and they see a stage. And I think we can bring the performer on the side of the stage so that it's not like purely frontal, but you also have something happening on the side, because in this version you have things happening on every side. You have dancers in your back, in your left, in your right, and in the front. And whatever point of view you choose, you have different shows, but pretty much the same shows happening with some slight differences.
Yeah, I was talking to Jordana Lee, and she was saying that when she saw it in Paris, there was a projection map, which when she was looking at through the VR headset, she said it sort of filled in the gaps of, because there's cutouts for mixed reality, where there's mixed reality with the kind of VR overlay on top of it, and then there's kind of cutouts that then you see the dancers dancing there. And she said that the projection map served to kind of close those gaps a little bit. So when I saw it here, then yeah, I was sitting down and able to look around, and you do have these like cutouts where the dancers are dancing, and then oftentimes dancing next to motion captured of maybe even the same dancers of similar movements. And there was a lot of times when they were like nearly identically synchronized, and that sometimes slightly ahead or slightly behind, but there seemed to be a choreographed set of moves that were also mimicked within the virtual realm. And yeah, so just wanted to stop there and pause if you have any comments, and we'll sort of dig into some of the other virtual components of the piece.
Yeah, the idea of Blanca is really you have the real dancers and the virtual dancers, and they dance together, so they have to do a choreography which matches as much as we can. So of course, I mean, the dancers, they don't see the virtual things. You cannot dance with headsets. They are on top of scaffolding, so the security requires them to be really aware of what's happening. But because they created the choreography, they know the choreographies of the virtual dancers. Even if they don't see it, they know what the virtual dancers are doing. We spent a lot of time in the rehearsal where we were doing a projection of the virtual dancers on the wall, so they would see what was happening and they could train to match that. The idea is not that they match perfectly. I think contemporary choreography means that you have choreography which each individual has its own independence and style and movements. And the idea also of the shadows is that the shadow sometimes is the shadow and reflects exactly what the human being is, but it gets independent, so it does different moves. There is a part which we call 2D 3D, where the shadows come out as white 3D characters out of the wall, and they do very similar moves from the dancers, but then they go back into the wall, but they don't do exactly the same moves. So the moves are slightly different. And of course, I mean, for the timing, there is also some kind of imperfection in the running of the VR and the running of the choreography, which makes that sometimes it's not exactly timed as precisely as it would be if there would be live dancers.
Yeah, it ends up being a really neat effect to see the dual choreographies of the real-time dancers and the pre-recorded motion captures, and the way that they're interplaying with each other was really fun to watch. And just curious to hear around the overall world design that you have, because there's lots of different scenes from like the top of a cityscape and other ways that you're doing things that would be impossible to do within physical reality, and have big, large scale, almost like immersive art installations of large scale objects that are flying through, but lots of dynamic movement through the space, I noticed. And so, yeah, just curious to hear a bit more around the virtual elements throughout the course of the shadow.
I think what Blanca discovered with virtual reality is there is no limit with the space. So she loves to play with the dimensions of the space and also of the characters. You've noticed that there are small characters and large characters. There are giants which are also performing. And this kind of scaling of the characters and of the space is really something she enjoys playing with. And even though we are in a 10 meter by 24 meters venue, there is a lot of space that the audience can see, which is much higher, much wider, and much longer. And when you're in the city, you can see the background of the city really far away. There are some really abstract settings where there's no city, but there's like infinite space. And sometimes you become immersed in, I mean, the idea is that she played with different types of spaces and tried to immerse the audience within. And also, what I think is the most interesting and which really needs virtual reality is that things happen in the middle of the audience. Like at the beginning, you have cats walking through the space in the middle of the people. And of course, I mean, you cannot have a real cat doing that without being afraid. And so this is just the beginning, but then there's a lot of things that happen and virtual dancers that happen to be in contact with the audience. And at the end, in the last scene, the idea was that the audience, at the beginning, you're very aware of what's virtual and what's real, because it's lighted and it's clear that it is. And by the end, I think many spectators are really wondering whether some elements are real and some elements are virtual. And we play with this by introducing more real elements which people believe are virtual. And on the contrary, you have virtual dancers that look like real ones and real dancers that look like virtual ones.
Yeah, it was a real masterful blending and blurring of all the different realities throughout the course of the experience. I wanted to ask about the music, because you mentioned the composer, and also that there seemed to be like a track that's playing in the background of audio soundtrack, but on top of the live music that's being played. And it seemed like the musician's sort of keeping time and playing, but I don't know like how much variance there is from performance to performance, because there's a lot of things that are cued from what is happening in the virtual reality experience versus what also all the dancers are doing and also being synchronized. And so just curious to hear around the music and the composition, and if it does end up being pretty much the same every time, or if there's quite a lot of variance over time.
The music is very written, so it's supposed to play exactly on the same timing, and it's a very precise timing. There is a recorded part, which is all the electronic part and the sound effects. There's a lot of sound effects that come either through the headsets or through the sound system. The sound system is very sophisticated. It's designed by IRCAM. They use like a special sound with more than 60 different sources of sound in different loudspeakers, and they make the sound go around and coming from either part of the space, or sometimes you have the feeling that it's very close or pretty far away. And on top of that, the live percussionist plays his part, his score. He has a score in front of him, so he knows exactly the timing, and he follows the electronic music recording to know what he has to perform, and the dancers also follow the musical part so that they know where they have to perform. So the music is very timed and very precise, and it is actually the leading element which allows all the rest to happen. Now, there are differences, of course, because live music is always different every day. So we had two different percussionists. They don't play exactly the same way, even though they play the same score. And this percussionist also plays differently depending on his mood every day. So after every performance, we say, oh, today was a very good day, and you performed very loud and strong, and you had a lot of energy. And he says, yes. Today I felt fantastic, and some other day is more soft and more, you have to hear a little more what he's performing, and it's more delicate, and there's a lot of different performances, and it's really a show because it happens on all the sides, and you can get closer to one side or to the other side and see some of the dancers up close and come back and see the other ones that some people like to see different times. I've seen it many times, and to me, every time I've seen it was a different show.
Yeah, and speaking of the sound, one thing that I really appreciated was that it was like a full, rich, like surround sound, and then you have the percussionist, the audio that's coming directly from those drums, and then there was, sometimes there would be like a swinging virtual being that was kind of going by, and then there was audio that was coming from my headset that was replicating the virtual objects that were going through. So it seemed like there was at least those three levels of sound, of the audio coming from the surround sound speakers, the percussionist, and the audio that's coming from the headset, that's all kind of blending together to create a singular audio experience.
Yeah. The sound design is a very strong part, and actually these three sources, and actually every source is a mix, like the percussionist is also amplified. And some of his live performance not only comes from where he sits, but also through the speakers. And there's sound from the headsets that includes mostly the sound effects, like you say, the swing and the rain and the storm and the fireworks. But also, I mean, we tried in the sound design to think what would be the best way to put it. Is it only in the headset, or is it in the sound system and the headsets? And so that was a lot of work to reach the final sound design.
And when I was watching the piece, I'm not familiar with the Hans Christian Andersen story, and so I guess the story was a bit lost on me in terms of like trying to follow what the story was. But if people are familiar with that story, is all the dance replicating it? And are people able to watch it and kind of interpret what is happening in the story?
Blanca's point of view is that when she does work, she uses inspiration from other works, like literary works. But she doesn't want the audience to be especially following a story. So it's really a source of inspiration for Blanca to create scenes. But then, of course, the scenes follow a kind of a loose scenario, but many times it's very abstract and it's not like a storytelling. And even though I think the beginning is a cityscape where people are leading their life as usual. And then there is a room where a scientist is isolated and in his work. And then he finds through his windows that there is a beautiful woman in the building in front, and he feels shy and doesn't want to go there. So that's when science allows him to give independence to his own shadow, so he sends his shadows across, and that's when the virtual reality comes really in, and there's a duo of the shadow of the scientist from his balcony and the shadow of the woman in the opposite balconies dancing together in the space. And from that, once the shadow gets its independence, the story becomes even more abstract, because the idea is that there is an abstract world where the shadow lives, and different characters which don't have bodies and only have costumes live in an alternative kind of space. And at the end, the shadow comes back and kills the scientist. So the last scene is the burial of the scientist. But the idea of Blanca about this story is because it is a scientist who creates something that in return threatens him. There is a lot of questioning now about artificial intelligence. Like, are we scientists, because I'm also a scientist, are creating something that is threatening the existence of humankind? And many people think that it is the case, and that maybe not now, but in a few years from now, if robots are built by robots and operating under AI systems, which will be also designed by other AI systems like second or third generations, they might become really independent and they might be able to take decisions and they might be able to surpass and to make human beings a lot less able to control the whole world of machines that surrounds us. So the point of view of Blanca is that we shouldn't be afraid of machines and programs, but we should be aware of what they offer. And like every scientific discovery, of course, there is a use of it which can be a threat. And if we are aware of the threats that all these scientific discoveries are giving, we should be able, as a collective humanity, to think about it and to be careful of using it for the benefit of humankind and not for its doom. Even though, I mean, when you look in the past, atomic energy was used to make atomic bombs. And you can discuss whether atomic bombs are really the doom of humanity. In a way, they are. And in another way, they've been like dissuasive elements that avoid wars to become too threatening. So, I mean, it's a philosophical discussion that goes on and on and on. And I think nobody has the answer, but every one of us should think about it. So the idea of this shadow show was also, in an abstract way and in a very humble way, to tell people, look, we can do new things with technology, with science. We can make things that you wouldn't think would be possible before. And when you see things becoming possible, we should be aware that it can be done for art, it can be done for doing beautiful things, but also, like all these digital image creation is doing things which are harming people, like all the deep fakes and things which are used for worse endeavors.
Yeah, just a quick follow-on on the individuation of the shadow and kind of into more and more of the abstract realms. There was a point where there was like letters with legs and feet and numbers. And so I'm just curious if that was a shadow coming into itself and reaching into abstractions, or yeah, just trying to get a sense of the story behind those letters and numbers that were dancing as well.
That was a decision that was made by Blanca and the graphical director. So she worked very close with a graphical director who is somebody we work with for many years, whose name is Vincent Chazal. And he designed also all the Le Bal de Paris with an aesthetic that tried to be, we call it retrofuturist. And in this tale interpretation, he followed pretty much the same spirit. So his idea was to create artificial elements that would be recognizable as part of our civilization. So letters and numbers was a very good way to have graphical elements that, even though you're in a fully artificial world, you recognize as human creation. And so his use of letters and numbers throughout the piece is a deliberate choice that he made. When you are in the further away world, there are nearly only numbers and letters and some legs that represent still a kind of human presence. But when you are more in the real world, then you have more humans, but you still have, if you look around, a lot of letters. So the balance between human and letters is something which was a play all through the show.
And so in thinking about dance in the context of XR, in immersive works. I think of Sleep No More as an example where they're using dance to like translate Macbeth into like a whole performance, and they're able to take the structure of Macbeth and kind of act out the different scenes. And there's no language that, you know, aside from a few brief scenes from Lady Macbeth in the context of Sleep No More, but for the most part, there's no language or no words being exchanged. And as an audience member going through Sleep No More, it put me into a little bit of an altered state, almost like walking through a dream. And there's a way that the dance is able to maybe communicate at a pure emotional level, even if like the clarity of the words or the meaning or the full context isn't always clear. It at least is a mode of transmitting emotional information, or at least sometimes the gestures and the other context can make it so that it's almost like a form of language that can be communicating as well. And so just curious to hear any thoughts on the way that dance could be melded with XR and immersive experiences that has other ways of accessing communicating that go beyond language and other abstractions.
So for Blanca, dance is a universal language that doesn't need translation. And that's what helps the company tour so many places, is like the same show can be performed in different places across the world. Of course, the audience doesn't perceive it the same way, but they always perceive the same artwork and they interpret it differently. But the idea is that the language of dance doesn't need translation to begin with. When we did Le Bal de Paris, we did, because there was a lot of singing and the singing was content, we did a different languages version. We did so far 6 versions, 1 French, Spanish, English, German, Italian, and Chinese, Mandarin versions that were, but it's a limitation. So the idea is that if we can do something which there is no language, it travels a lot better. And it reaches the audience in a way that a painting, music without words, or choreography, or visual arts, any kind of visual experience can reach the soul of the audience.
Great. And so what's next for The Shadow?
What's next for Blanca and The Shadow is that we have a large project which is inspired by her directing the Teatros del Canal in Madrid, in which she thought professional and artists sometimes need to travel and to transport a lot of things, and it's difficult. And if we could meet together in a virtual space, which would be 2 years ago called the Metaverse, that she wants to create a cultural center, like a virtual cultural center, where the professional from the performing arts and visual arts, where the artists from performing arts and visual arts, where the audience can be together and experience with the best quality possible shows, conferences, presentations, exhibitions. And so this is our next project. And every time we do something which is virtual, we think, how are we going to integrate it into this virtual cultural center? Every time I see a beautiful experience like here, there are many of them, I'm thinking, if we want to integrate it into our virtual cultural center, we will need to do this and this and this. And so this is the motivation for building this center and trying to be able to offer an audience which is remote. Many people are in a hospital bed, they are in prison, they are remote, or they live in places which are very far away from theater and they cannot travel, or very far from Venice. I mean, this place in Venice is amazing. I mean, this is really inspiring so much for creative possibilities of VR. And we think if it was possible for everybody around the world to be able to come and see this in a metaverse, then that would be really a fantastic idea. So this is really our next main project, but Blanca also has other projects with classical kind of stage shows. So she does a lot of stage shows, and she wants also to do film, because she's a film director, and she did all 3 feature films, but she thinks 360 film is really something interesting which she would like to experience. So we have many projects in her mind that we will give life to in the next few years.
Yeah, speaking of film, and here at Venice, there's a piece called On the Other Earth by Wayne McGregor, which is in a kind of a a circular LED wall that is encompassing like 9 people, but it features an hour-long dance performance. Just curious if you or Bianca had a chance to see that and share any thoughts.
I haven't seen it yet, but I'm going to see it tomorrow. It was a must, absolutely.
Okay, yeah, for sure. Great. Well, I guess as we start to wrap up, I'd love to hear what you think the ultimate potential of XR and all these immersive technologies and the intersection of dance, what that ultimate potential might be and what it might be able to enable.
Well, as we talked, I mean, it was clear that dance is a kind of performance which adapts very well with visual arts. And for me, XR is a new medium of visual arts. So also the possibilities of XR are amazingly varied. What we see around here is many, many different ways of taking the medium and doing something different, from certain experiences which are like gaming, animation, and others which are like more filming, documentary, and just like magical experiences. And so all of these, which is differently taken by different artists, is as inspiring as dance, because at some point there was classical dance and then contemporary dance went and broke the whole wall of tradition and made everything possible. So XR made everything possible in terms of, I would say, cinematic experience, because XR is basically a cinematic experience. And associating it with dance, with contemporary dance, gives it the potential to really become a singular show experience for audiences. And of course, Blanca comes from the performing arts, so she always wants the medium to be reminding you that if there is live performance, it's very interesting. It's much more interesting than just recording things. We, of course, do recorded things. Film is recorded, but when it's associated with live performance, it's more interesting. And scaling up to really have like an economical model where we can have thousands of people coming to see a show, and I think it's something of a challenge that people come and see a live show which is associated with XR by the thousands, is something we consider as one of our mission.
Right. Is there anything else that's left unsaid that you'd like to say to the broader immersive community? Any final thoughts?
So if I have a message for the immersive community, it would be in the line of what I just said. Every time you can scale up and think of how you can reach a wider audience, it will help pave the way for a better recognition, better financement, better marketing of the VR and the XR market. There are some experiences which are designed for many, many people, like museum experiences, like Cheops and Notre Dame and things like this, which are actually doing a lot more audiences than we do. And they are interesting, of course. There is also Infinity, which was produced by Centerfee, which was very interesting and did large audiences. And I think we should look to these to see where can we make our work more visible. And it's not a matter of quality or things. It's a matter of reaching wider audiences. I think it's what I would say the XR community is, find a way to reach a wider audience.
Awesome. Well, thanks again so much for joining me today on the podcast to share a little bit more around the creation of The Shadow and all the work that you're doing to not only do this fusion of performing arts and dance with mixed reality, but also all the large scale, having lots of throughput of people seeing the experience. Like you said, it's a really important part of, you know, making it a sustainable and viable venture for people to both invest in, but also produce more pieces like you're doing. And so really cutting edge, and I think shows the potential of kind of a really large scale mixed reality performance that's really quite awe-inspiring. So yeah, thanks again for joining me here on the podcast to help break it all down.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks so much for tuning into this Venice Immersive 2025 coverage, and hopefully you found some use in some of this documentation of these experiences that are very ephemeral. And some of these show at these festivals and they don't really go out
widely beyond this a lot of times. I mean, maybe they are, but you may not be in a place that it's easy for you to see them. And so it's a real privilege to be able to see all these experiences, but also to be able to sit down with these creators and have a really deep in-depth conversation in a way that there are not a lot of other opportunities to really dig into at this level. And so I really appreciate all the time from all the creators to be able to have these conversations, but also for you to take the time to listen to them. And also, it's been a challenge of trying to find a way of speaking about these experiences in an abstract, theoretical way, or at least in a way that I can ground it and allow you to put yourself into the experiences to kind of imagine some of these different things that they're doing, how I'm experiencing it, but also the different types of design decisions that the creator is making. So if you find this useful and want to support this type of effort of both documenting the history of immersive storytelling, but also to support this kind of wildly ambitious independent journalism project that is very much driven by support by listeners like yourself. So please do consider becoming a member of the Patreon at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening. Thank you.